This is episode 2, part 2 of Books, Films, Tilly. This is your host, Tilly. And today we'll be discussing Decision to Leave, directed by Park Chan-wook. As I said at the beginning of Matthew and I's Dracula episode, originally I was supposed to do this with him, but he had transport issues, so he arrived to the screening very late. And my vision for this episode was for us to give our immediate thoughts in the 24 hours after. And when we realised that it simply wasn't going to be possible for Matthew, we both agreed that I just have to do it justice alone and at a later date. Even though we both thought it was brilliant on a cinematographic sound and acting level. But I'm sorry that he's not here with me now. This is basically a short ode, not very short, but an ode to Decision to Leave and all its subtle details, the ones like that you can pick up on and that I did pick up on the first time. Before we start, my points of analysis and the details I've decided to include in this episode are all elements of the film that I personally found fascinating and picked up on myself. I used an article on the website Polygon once or twice simply to provide context, but otherwise all that I discuss comes from myself. Unless I say otherwise, I feel like that goes without saying, but I wanted to clarify. I chose... just talking about being original. But I actually chose this film because Kirsten Runquist was doing a video about the Oscar nominations when they came out. And he was kind of expressing his opinions on them. And he has talked about Decision to Leave in some of his previous episodes, and he has actually done a full YouTube video on it. And because I discuss it later on the podcast, I will link it in the description, but I hadn't watched it. And basically, it's not been nominated for Best International Film, and so Kirsten Runquist was basically explaining that he felt it was snubbed. So I felt like I should go watch it. It was in the cinemas. So I went to go watch it. It's been very popular in Korea. It ranked in the top 10 all-time Korean box office hits. It's been highly successful, and I am really glad that I picked it. I didn't think it was a romance at first, because I went in essentially blind, and my goal was to pick a movie that was actually a bit different from what I usually enjoy, but instead, it flawlessly delivered many of the different elements I love in cinema and in romance. It was basically meant for me. I can't cover everything I wish to say about this film in 1 hour, and probably not in two. But if you haven't watched it, please do so soon. I'm tempted to tell you to stop listening now and go watch it now so you can experience it without the expectations that this episode might set. But that would make for a very short podcast episode and wouldn't be very good for my listener stats. But do go watch it. Yeah, it caught me by surprise, that's what I'm saying, and I'm glad I did go in there blind without knowing what to expect, because I think it really enhanced the experience for me. Decision to Leave is a crime police procedural romance film directed by Park Chan-wook. Detective Chang Hae-chun is a workaholic dedicated to his job, very organised, he's very professional. Like, he's described as being very dignified in some of the interviews with the director. And at the beginning of the film, he is called out to a crime scene where a man appears to have fallen from the top of a cliff, a mountain, in a climbing accident. And the dead man's wife, Song So-rae, a pretty and young Chinese woman, is called in to identify the body and for light questioning, but she quickly comes under suspicion. And Decision to Leave is about the evolution of Hae-chun and So-rae's relationship in the context of multiple crimes, as well as being a more general commentary on love and romance and relationships. If you've never been a fan of romance with, you know, The Notebook, being too sappy, and TV series such as Normal People feeling too heavy and maybe too depressing. This is a truly, I think exquisite is the right word to use here. It's a truly exquisite in between, and I adored it. I genuinely did. At the end of our screening, they played an interview between Bong Joon-ho, best known for being the director, co-writer, and co-producer of Parasite, and Park Chan-wook, who is the director of Decision to Leave. And it's fair to say that whilst I recognised that there were romantic elements, I remained a little uncertain as to how I was meant to interpret this film before I listened to it. And then when it was explained, if you see it that way, you understand it that way, but it is a bit ambiguous, and that's part of its charm. And so in this interview, Park Chan-wook actually clarifies that he most definitely intended this to be a romance. This isn't an exact quote what I watched, because I couldn't find the exact interview, which is reassuring, considering I kind of paid for it to be part of my viewing experience. But this is an extract from this interview that I found on Polygon, which is a website, and I'll link the article down below because it talks about the movie as a whole in quite a good way if you find this episode interesting as well. And basically, Park Chan-wook acknowledges that many of his films contain a lot of violence and sex with high maturity ratings, and he states that, this is the beginning of the quote, "Even when I do make a romance film, people will look at the eroticism rather than the romanticism that was supposed to be conveyed. I wanted to break away from those misjudgments, which is why I tried to get rid of those elements in this film." So you can already tell that this is a film in which a lot of restraint has been shown specifically to enhance the main topic of the film. You can really tell. Park Chan-wook said he wanted it to be a classic too, in the sense that he wanted it to stand out as a uniquely impressive piece of cinematic work, and I truly believe he delivered. Throughout the history of the arts, I believe there have been many attempts to write romance and love in a realistic fashion. And I think the reoccurring difficulty being, in my opinion, writing a film about love in a realistic manner and still keeping it as a romance. The question, you know, the tough question being, can this balance be achieved? And I'm afraid that despite many attempts, I don't think I'd watched a film or a television series. I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction, so I can't say book. That wouldn't be fair. But I don't think I'd watched a film or a TV series that got nearly as close to that golden objective as Decision to Leave. But I really hope it isn't the last piece of media that I consume that gets this close. It's so wonderfully understated and yet gorgeous too. Its cinematography and transitions are, they're fantastic. The whole entire viewing experience is amazing. Please go watch it, just savour it. This film portrays love and romance artfully and truly distinguished itself through its masterful execution, both stylistically and vis-a-vis of its genres and its topics. I'm not going to lie, I'm going to mainly focus on the romantic side of this, but the procedural side of this film is brilliant. It's well explained to the audience when resolved, but also remains just beyond the audience's reach before the conclusion of each case. And part of what is wonderful about this film is that the context is not a simple setting for their romance to unfold in. The context is an integral part of their romance. It stays, which keeps everything rooted in real life. It has to unfold in the confines of this mundane existence and this mundane setting. And this is its, you know, first characteristic among many that removes it from the chick flick romance and into a bit more human, I want to say human setting, even though the circumstances remain, you know, pretty extraordinary. This is a murder case, it's not everyday life. The cases are how the stages of their relationship are defined. Death and Haijun's job, so the detective's job, are the reason this relationship flourishes. Therefore, the relationship essentially cannot live without the crime element of this film. And it is always there, which is, it's brilliant, it's so good. And Haijun is constantly invested in his work, constantly preoccupied by it, to the point that it's implied that he can't sleep at night, he has insomnia, there we go. Because his cold cases are what he thinks about at night. He is incessant when it comes to his work. And so when that focus falls on Soo-rae as his suspect, she adores it. Because she is finally being seen after being in, this is such an understatement, but after being in such a loveless marriage, Haijun, he obsesses over her. He conducts stakeouts, records her, takes photographs of her, all under the guise of professionality, of course. And so his love for work becomes his love for her. And he begins learning Chinese and wishes to keep the pictures of her that he took of her during his stakeout. And then when asked, what's interesting and how we know that part of the reason she is so enamored by him is because he recognizes her charm, her intelligence, is because when asked about her immigration officer husband, she explains that when she was caught trying to smuggle her way into Korea among a group of Chinese people, he was the one who saw her, even when she was dirty and emaciated, and that's why she allowed herself to get married to him. I think that's what's implied. And it's that act of seeing that she appreciates about Haijun. But this is more interpretation than spelled out. But yeah, that's basically it. The case is the setting for their love. It always is. And it's worth noting that before watching it, although the film does well to imply it. This film had so much of it that wasn't simply to advance the plot, you know? This film was a collection of small moments given importance by their emotional significance. And that's how life is. Life is a collection of small moments. And that's where you can find love and where love happens. so yeah, it's just, it's brilliant. I keep saying it's brilliant, but it really is. To give you a first idea of how subtle this film is, there is this continuous apparition of ambiguity which seems to reflect the feeling of trying to decode someone's emotions when we have romantic feelings for them in particular. We get, first of all, we get this feeling, like this feeling of threat. We feel kind of threatened. I think we believe almost to the end that Soo-rae will be the death of Haijun. So many times we are also led to believe so. I won't tell you what that amounts to, but yeah. And we get this continuous sense that they're playing cat and mouse, with Soo-rae always being one step ahead of him, even in their relationship and in the case. You know, we're asking ourselves, does she wish to kill him? Does she intend to? Why is she recording their conversation for the first time in the film? Is it to blackmail him? Is she covering her tracks? Does she love him? Or is she just trying to get close to him to infiltrate the case? I think, I don't know, Matthew didn't feel this way. He was there for this bit, but personally, I thought she might have killed herself at one point. And so, yeah, I had no idea until the very end as to the motives or, you know, like what was going on with at least Soray's emotions. So, as I was saying, that ambiguity, it remains to the very end. And even then, we don't have a conclusive understanding of the events that happened at the end of the film and why they played out that way. So we too become the detective kept awake by an unsolved case. And that ambiguity is also found in other scenes with other characters and is aided by the camera work, which is just so clever. So clever. So we are left stumbling behind this film, hoping it'll give us a clarification for what we have seen, for the chemistry that we have watched play out in front of us. And we're hoping that the film will explain all those things that made us question the integrity of their connection, but also all those things that made us believe in them. Will they confirm our beliefs in either side? And there was no big moment where we realized that there was chemistry between them. You know, in a lot of rom-coms, there's like a moment where they've just had a great day laughing and smiling, and then they kind of look at each other with really big eyes and you're like, oh, finally they've realized that they like each other. No. Here, it was a quiet and gradual progression. So we, the audience, were reduced to basically mimicking having a crush and trying to discern intentions and chemistry between the two of them, and with the hope that when everything, you know, when everything is subtracted and added up, this will give us an actual understanding of the others, our crush's feelings, or here's Soray's feelings. And in the end, I enjoyed how the revealing of whether or not, you know, Soray actually has feelings for him is still subtle. It's still coded. It's still marked by its singularity, because we understand simply because we know. Not because of the simplicity of the words or that it's spelled out, but because she confirms with a recognition of some of those details that I will not be pointing out to you because you need to experience the film. I'm a big appreciator of details in all things arts. I adore trying to decode the intention behind every moment of focus on any insignificant detail and the meaning behind actions in narrative arts. I think that's a well put way of saying books, films, and television series. Probably going to use it a lot more. I hope that makes sense. I explained it here. You were here. And to me, that's how many fantastic films distinguish themselves. They stand out to me when I can feel the intention in each choice made behind the scenes. And I think this is in part because I read a lot of fantasy, and much of it, at least at the moment, or at least the fantasy that I'm reading at the moment, it's about collecting as many stray details as possible simply to follow the plot. Never mind guess what's going to happen next. You just have to keep cataloguing information. So I think I was doing the same thing when I'm watching this film. And there was, the details in this film don't necessarily have an end goal. They're just so intelligent and wonderfully placed, and they are so representative of the care taken in this film, and you really, like, you feel it. It's, you really, really do. Without further ado, I would like to tell you, as I said, this is an ode to the details of Decision to Love, so I might as well get started. without further ado, I would like to tell you some of my favourite uses of details to transmit commentary on romance, love, and relationships to the audience, because this is really a masterclass on how to do it, all of those things simultaneously, and consequently explains why this is such a good romance. I have been waiting for another film like this. I have one other film in mind that resembles this one, but it's so like, I can't, it would take me far too long to explain why it's similar. And I don't want to spoil that film because I'd actually quite like to discuss it in future episodes. But yeah. If you do watch it, do tell me if you have any other films that you think are like this one, because I'd be really interested, especially if you've got any recommendations and it's not the film that I'm thinking about. One of the key arguments I feel is present in this film is that loving someone is both an act of understanding and an act of knowing, and therefore falling in love is the act of harnessing those things, of cultivating those things. And that's very literally shown by Haishun learning Chinese, because Shouwei is Chinese and the actress is also Chinese, and it's super interesting because there's a lot to be said about the fact that she's a foreigner, and we literally could not get the full effect unless we spoke Korean, because if you're like me, you don't speak Korean and you were watching the whole thing with subtitles. But she speaks in, based on the interview, I know this based on the interview, but based on the interview, she uses sometimes very fancy words because she has learnt them from the K-dramas she's watched. And she also sometimes does have difficulty expressing herself, and that is shown by her use of, I think, Google Translate, definitely like a translating app where she speaks in Chinese and then it speaks for her. And actually it's really, really cool because in the final scene, she says, like, her last bit, and she says it in Chinese, and he says, say it in Korean, please, and she does. So it's really cool. I love it. back to the point, loving someone is an act of understanding and knowing, and therefore to fall in love with someone is to begin to understand and know them, and that means that also, you know, to express love is to demonstrate your knowledge and understanding another person. I mean, it's not, yeah. The act of loving someone being an act of understanding and knowing is also shown, you know, not only through the fact that Haishun is learning Chinese, but also in Sore's weird attempt to accommodate his fears. And there's this absolutely fantastic moment of contrast where we see Chung-an, Haishun's wife, he's married. Yeah, she's struggling, his wife, Chung-an, is struggling to find a baby wipe. You know, a wipe to clean her hands after touching a dead fish at a market. And she cannot for the life of her find it in his pockets for ages. Haishun, he has these tailor-made outfits with extra pockets, and he's also very organized. So it is implied, and it was implied in the interview, that everything is always in the same place. But even if you didn't know that, what's fantastic is that then later, So-rae simply reaches inside Haishun's pocket and pulls out a lip balm that she knows is there from one simple exchange over a year ago. And she just puts it on. Yeah, it's brilliant. Love, I think the message here is that love can be found in the intimacy that comes with knowing someone. You know, falling in love is the act of getting to know someone, of wanting to know someone as well, which is also displayed by the detective's obsessive stakeouts, and also by the fact that he keeps these recordings of her as well. And even when love has faded, it's still proof of what you used to have, that knowledge. It's like that knowledge is a stamp marking what once was. And we see that when it comes to his wife, Chung-an, as well. She knows how hard it was for him to stop smoking, for example. Light spoilers. Just tune out for 10 seconds if you don't want to hear anything. It's not that bad, but just, you can go la 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 for the next 10 seconds. Much of the second half of the film, I truly believe, revolves around So-rae trying to reignite that understanding between her and the detective, but the detective no longer wants to have that understanding with her. There we go. That's all I had to say. The addition of Haishun being married is perfect. Oh my goodness. He's so content with doing mundane tasks with So-rae than when doing them with his wife. Like, doing them with his wife seems to suck the life out of him, which shows there's a greater meaning behind his indifference to his wife. He's not tired of domesticity. He's tired of her. And by bringing in this idea, that idea of love being something more, by bringing in this idea, I really dislike Taishun. Like, whilst I still thoroughly appreciate the dynamics between him and So-rae, I don't find him respectful and dignified the way he is described in the interview by Park Chan-wook. Because I think almost by showing that, you know, whether Park Chan-wook means it or not, by showing that love is an act of knowing someone, and through the way that he portrays their love, So-rae and the detective's love, or at least the detective's love for So-rae, and the pure simplicity of it, he demonstrates how people cheat in different ways. That's, you know, that's what the movie's about how romance is not simply sex and violence in the name of love. It's not big dramatic gestures and big grand moments. No, it's intimacy, it's happiness in domesticity, it's enjoying cooking dinner, it's helping them go to sleep. And again, that's another parallel, is the fact that So-rae helps him go to sleep, and at the same time his wife is later also trying to help him go to sleep, but in a different way, and he just cannot accept that. He doesn't like that. He's simply stopped. Haishun has simply stopped appreciating his wife, and he stopped trying for her, and that's why I don't like him. Carsten Runquist did this great video explaining an underlying motive in this film, and I'll link the video in the description because it helped with some stuff I didn't really understand. And I'm very grateful for the existence of that video. Luckily, it didn't affect any of the other stuff that I'm talking about here. But basically, it's based off of this quote by Confucius. Don't know how to pronounce it in English, I'm afraid. I'm sorry. And the sea and the mountain. And consequently, this idea of sea and mountain people. And it's implied that Haishun is a mountain person by a number of factors, and as I said, Carsten does a great job of showing them and highlighting them. So Carsten mentions that once you get to the top of a mountain as well, in some of his analysis, that's it. There's nothing left to do, but once you've conquered a mountain, you've conquered it. And so if we were to see marriage as potentially for some people being an act of conquering, I think we can distinguish two types of mountain people. Whilst some people do climb mountains for the sake of saying they have conquered a mountain, so many people will go up a mountain to sit there and enjoy the view. There are different mountain people, and Haishun is the conquering type, aka once he's conquered it, he's conquered it, which reflects on his marriage. I believe it's just marriage is a resolution of yet another thing. And as I said, it reflects on his marriage and his inability to appreciate what he already has. It's shown in the way mountains are used as part of the plot. And it explains his fascination. So-rae, a sea person, very untamable and ever-changing. And on the other hand, we have So-rae's husband, who, all many things aside, sits up on his mountain and takes a moment to appreciate the view. I won't say more on this, because otherwise I would just be regurgitating what he said. But do check out the video if you plan on watching it, or if you have watched it, because I think it's worth it. It's a great video. I I previously mentioned, you know, Haesyun, he's married. So let's talk about Chung-an. I could talk about her for ages because she is such a good character. In fact, no character is poorly used in this film, like, truly. You can watch this film many times and I think you pick up new details every time. And my absolute favourite detail of this film only kind of registered in my mind, only came to me the day after I'd watched it. So, yeah, I'm going to explain it to you now. Chung-an is, it's important to say, Chung-an is far from being a bad wife. And there are continuous attempts on her part to hold their relationship together. But the most remarkable scene between Chung-an and Haesyun, aka the detective, this scene unfolds as such. So Haesyun and Chung-an are sitting side by side on the floor gutting pomegranates. And Chung-an mentions that pomegranates are a good way to delay menopause, or are thought to help delay menopause. To which Haesyun replies that he doesn't understand why she'd wish to delay it, because menopause would make things easier for her. It's so good. It's so good. Because here we have both the metaphorical symbol of trying to keep someone with you in the form of the pomegranate, with, you know, Hades and Persephone, and then a hint, I don't want to say the more modern way, because it's something that has been, I think it's been used a lot throughout time, but maybe a more literal way is the best way to put it. More literal way of trying to keep someone close to you, which is to have a child with them. It's incredible. I love it. I love it so much. And I thought about that scene for ages. I can picture it in my mind. And I think, that's so brilliant. That's so wonderful. I love it so much. And it's because it doesn't have a parallel in the film as well. Like, you just have to remember that seemingly rather unremarkable scene, which is appears to be just a testament as to this marriage that is falling apart because Haesyun doesn't care enough. And it could simply just escape your perception. I'd love to know if people have watched that. I want to know if people had picked up on that so badly. But yeah, I was mind blown when I actually thought about that the day after. Really genuinely mind blown. So in this film, at the same time, we see the actor falling in love and falling out of it with two women trying to conserve Haesyun's love in their own way. But as Chung-an says at the very beginning of this film, Haesyun was always and foremost in love with his cases and his job. And I think a lot of what this film implies is that marriage requires effort and care. And just Haesyun is appallingly disconnected from her. And I did also appreciate the fact that they didn't turn her into, she wasn't this horrible wife trying to keep him from his true love. And actually, it's the way that their side of the story unfolds is fantastic. Just everything. I don't want to spoil it. I don't want to spoil it so much, because I really want you to go into that and then realize why it's amazing. But there is no coincidence in this film. So we find all the stages of love, and such an accurate depiction of how it looks as it evolves. I was so tired of films and television series, no matter how good they are, okay? And books as well, because I've read a couple now, even though I said I don't read a lot of contemporary fiction, but actually I've read quite a few books based on love, in an attempt to kind of ease myself into contemporary fiction, because I quite like romance, and it just, I've hated it. But yeah, I'm really tired of films and television series and books only ever exploring love through depressing, toxic relationships. As though that's really what the opposite of a chick flick is, or that's always what is realistic. And as if that's what all relations actually, all relationships, sorry, actually feel like, which to a certain degree some of them do, but that's not what the act of falling in love and being in love feels like. You know, I don't know, I love your opinions, but no matter how toxic a relationship, I feel there is a moment. Because they're not, okay, their relationship is not completely untoxic, but you're almost mesmerized by them. And I don't know, I haven't seen that recently. I haven't seen a true appreciation of the act of falling in love. And I felt that here. I loved Soray and Haejun, all things considered, and his wife brought a wonderful balance, and this film covers so much in such a spectacular and delightful manner. I cannot wait to rewatch it, you know. I really can't. But for you guys, I have set up, well, set up, written a list. I was just laughing at myself. I have set up, I sound like a mum setting up an Easter egg hunt, but I have set up a list of some last few details that I picked up on the first time I watched it, and that would be spoilers, or would not be, it wouldn't be very fun of me if I told you about them. And I would like you to look out for them if you watch it, or you can tell me if you noticed them when you watched it. Yeah, so I got really confused when I started talking about the Cheshire Hunt, Easter Eggs Hunt stuff. I lost my train of thought. But yeah, so here's my list. Here's my questions. Here's my list. How classy are Soray and Haejun? And how does this evolve for both characters? When does Soray finally wear mourning clothes? What do they eat during the interrogations? So, the watches. When does he put teardrops in? It's so cool. In which moments does Haejun lose his cool? And another personal favourite detail of mine, and I wish I could have talked about it, was what is the common theme for the resolution of, yeah, you can say all three, definitely two. There's two very obvious similarities, but yeah, I don't know why I'm saying all three cases. Yeah, what is the similarity between the resolution of all three cases? I want to know what you think it is. I want to know if you're right. But yeah, so I got all that first time round, which I'm quite proud of. If I say so myself, maybe it's not something to be proud of. Maybe you'll all pick it up easily when you watch it. My question, though, besides my little treasure hunt, is also for those of you who are gonna watch it, is what's happening with the shoes? I was trying to follow them, because there's a lot of shots on their shoes, and I think there is one moment where I can sense that there is an intersection. But I want to know if there was a pattern. I would have needed a pen and paper to keep up with them. But I want to know if any of you picked up what the pattern was. Yeah, so let me know. Let me know if you figure out my list of details. I'd love to hear from you. So yeah. And besides that, as I said, the cinematography is equally insane in this film. You know, watch it for the cinematography, watch it for the lighting and the transitions, because they also make this movie. Yeah, so please go watch it. Now I've finished discussing basically 2 hours of my life that I really enjoyed, I'm gonna talk about the BAFTAs that I watched. Will be 2 weeks when this is released, because I've been sick. But as I'm recording this, it was a week ago, and you know, it's an award ceremony, isn't it? You're not going to agree with everything. I didn't particularly enjoy Aftersun, but it genuinely was made by its directing. So Charlotte Wells winning Outstanding Debut by a British writer, director, or producer was completely justified. It was one of the few ones I was really happy about. Otherwise, you know, the fact that Everything Everywhere All at Once only won one award and did not receive one of the supporting actor awards was ludicrous to me. 10 nominations. They had 10 nominations and they only got one award. And I'm just praying that they don't get snubbed the same way at the Academy. I think it would have been really funny to have them win special visual effects over Avatar. I'm not saying that Avatar wasn't truly the CGI accomplishment of the decade. It just would have been really funny to me. There was a very small team working on Everything Everywhere All at Once, so I think it would have been really fun. And then, you know, on a more objective level, the fact that despite constituting 40% of all the nominees, no person of colour won their category was frankly ridiculous and embarrassing. I guess I also need to speed up my plans to watch All Quiet on the Western Front now, because it won Best Film. And The Banshees of Inisherin, which I don't know if I'm going to like, because it's not really something that I enjoy watching, but I will let you guys know. The podcast social media will be linked in the episode's description. Once again, I'm sorry I couldn't do this with Matthew, but I really did enjoy doing that episode with him. I think a lot of you did enjoy the episode as well. I think that's how I'm going to be doing the episodes, with just either a book or a film, instead of trying to do both at the same time. Although, to be fair, Matthew and I really can talk forever, so that's possibly another reason why we went on for so long. I think I'll choose one or the other from now on. I wish you a good day. Let me know if you picked up on those details, and I hope you enjoy it.